Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for downloading, and I sure hope you enjoy the show today. This story is part two of a two-part presentation of the story of James Lotan, which in turn is part of a sequence of six related episodes walking through the literally earth-shattering events that resulted from a seemingly minor bit of Portland waterfront lawbreaking in the early 1890s. Today we'll finish the story of minor political hack James Lotan, who basically got the ball rolling when he was given a political sinecure that he could use to make some quick dirty money. Like we talked about last week, the gang that he partnered with to make that dirty money would probably have been fine if they hadn't decided to branch out from smuggling Chinese workers into the country and get into the opium business. Let's talk about how that went down now. Dunbar probably wasn't the one who decided to start smuggling opium. Most likely that innovation came from Dunbar's business partner, the co-owner of Merchant Steamship Company, a flamboyant and morally flexible cigar merchant named Nat Blum. The problem with opium was that although the stuff was still legal, it was taxed very heavily. That meant bringing the stuff in without paying the tax was tantamount to stealing money from the government. When Dunbar smuggled a Chinese guy into the country to work, yeah, that was illegal, but nobody really cared. It was a big country. There was a lot of work to be done. But when Dunbar smuggled a barrel of opium into the country, the government lost thousands of dollars in tax revenue. Most likely, Lotan didn't know about the opium until his partner's steamship started getting raided. Reading between the lines, criminals tend not to leave very complete records, it does appear that the opium was Nat Blum's idea. In any case, Blum did most of the day-to-day management of the opium operations. The idea was that the drugs would be rolled off the deck of the steamship in a barrel into a lonely stretch of the Willamette River before they reached the port, and then they would be retrieved by some of Blum's cronies later on. These cronies, guys like Bunko Kelly and Bob Garthorne, not to mention Nat Blum himself, would be the biggest weakness in this plan when it came to the opium. Put simply, they were just super incompetent. They lost nearly as much opium to theft, accident, and seizure as they actually brought in. And they brought in a lot. This was an industrial-scale operation, probably totaling well over 5 tons of product. By November 1893, the jig was just about up. One of the Merchant Steamship Company's two steamers had been seized by the federal government in Astoria, and the federal prosecutor in Portland was asking a grand jury to return indictments against Lotan, along with Dunbar and Blum and a number of their underworld cronies. Sade Back, the most prominent Chinese businessman in Portland, was also on the hook. The ensuing title held Portland spellbound. But Lotan hadn't much need to worry. The roster of court officers at this trial reads like an excerpt from the Arlington Club directory. Lotan was represented by future Senator Charles W. Fulton. Joseph Simon himself, remember him, came back home from his cushy Washington, D.C. position on the Republican National Committee to represent another defendant. Possibly most outrageously, federal prosecutor John Gearin, who had been just appointed by President Grover Cleveland as special prosecutor for opium frauds, was in the case of this particular opium fraud on the side of the defense. Also, the judge was one of Simon's former law partners, and the jury foreman was fellow Arlington Club member Charles Ladd. So the trial ended with a hung jury. The word on the street was that the vote was 11-1. Jury foreman Ladd had refused to vote to convict his friend. A new trial would have to be scheduled. Well, the process dragged on for a couple of years. Dunbar fled to China before he could be indicted. Blum, on the witness stand, got so creative in his testimony that by the end of the second trial, no one believed him anymore. Eventually, Blum disappeared and the whole thing just sort of faded away. As historian McCall writes, Lotan, supported through the ordeal by his establishment and Arlington Club comrades, survived with his reputation more or less intact. It has to be noted, though, that Lotan didn't stay president of the Oregon Republican Party for long after this indictment came down. No political party, even one as dominant as the GOP was in 1890s Oregon, can risk too much of that kind of publicity. So that's the end of the story as far as James Lotan was concerned. But you may be wondering about my admittedly clickbaity introduction to this story. How exactly could a sleazy, venal crook like James Lotan be credited with saving the world from the Nazi menace and or global thermonuclear destruction? Well, those of you who are familiar with the story of Yosuke Matsuoka, the young Japanese lad who grew up on the Portland waterfront, was known to his friends and comrades as Frank, who afterwards became the most important Imperial Japanese diplomat of the 20th century. Well, you'll know exactly where I'm going with this. And if you don't, well, that's what we're going to be covering in parts 3, 4, 5, and 6 of this sequence. But just to give you a little foretaste, Yosuke Matsuoka was the son of a failed shipping magnate in Japan who came to the U.S. to try to mend his family's fortunes for his widowed mother. He came to Vancouver when he was 12 and met Dunbar, who was in the process of processing in another cohort of Chinese laborers to be smuggled into Portland. Dunbar sort of informally adopted the gregarious lad and brought him home to serve as a companion for his 14-year-old son, Lambert. So young Yosuke grew up in the Dunbar home, kind of like the character of Haji in the old Johnny Quest cartoons. He grew up surrounded by all the players from top to bottom of what had to be the biggest and most well-connected drug smuggling operation in American history. Unless, of course, the rumors about the CIA are true. But when he returned to Japan, after graduating from the University of Oregon, he believed he knew America as well as he knew Japan, based on having lived there for half of his life. Of course, his experience of America was basically from the perspective of a regional organized crime family, like the Corleones in The Godfather. And as a top-ranking Japanese diplomat, Matsuoka always thought of Americans as being like the waterfront toughs and cowboy capitalists he palled around with in the 1890s, guys who respected guts and strength. Which is why, in 1940, Matsuoka worked so hard to forge an alliance between Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany. He figured being an official ally of the most powerful country in Europe would give Japan the strength and credibility to stand up to the U.S. Well, the result was the Tripartite Pact, which turned Japan into an Axis power. And after that, Japan was a tripwire that the Roosevelt administration could tug on to get the U.S. into the war with Nazi Germany. Which, of course, is exactly what happened. Whether the tugging was incidental or deliberate is another question. It certainly happened. So here's the sequence. Dunbar starts smuggling operations, which leads to Dunbar meeting Matsuoka and adopting him, which leads to Matsuoka getting a very wrong impression of America and Americans, which leads to Matsuoka bringing Japan into an alliance with Nazi Germany, which leads to Pearl Harbor and World War II, which leads to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which leads to the leaders and warlords of the entire world having seen with their own eyes what nuclear war looks like before they're ever entrusted with the power to unleash it. But that whole sequence of events would never have happened without James Lotan, the small-time political crook looking around to see who might be able to help him make some quick, dirty money, and reaching out to his recently widowed friend, William Dunbar. Key sources in this story included works by E. Kimbark McCall, David J. Liu, and the archives of the Portland Morning Oregonian and Portland Daily Telegraph. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 700 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources, all accessible through our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.